Okay. Starting at the beginning of Perek Aleph, last week we began our exploration of Kohelet with an introduction on the structure. What exactly our methodology? What is our approach to Kohelet going to be? How are we going to analyze one of the largest and most enigmatic Megillot, certainly, and one of the most difficult books in Tanakh? What I had suggested was a thesis that it was originally introduced by the Meiri in his commentary, Introduction to Mishlei, and then later, in recent times, developed in much more detail by in a partnership between Rav Yoav ben Nun and Rav Meidan, that Kohelet is actually an internal debate, that there are multiple voices in Kohelet. The multiple voices we're going to explore today, we're going to begin to introduce them to us today, but essentially, rather than looking at Kohelet as a consistent message and then struggling with the contradictions and the views, the problematic statements, etc., and rather than struggling with the drash of each one individually, rather look at the Sefer from a broad perspective and look at it as a conflict, an internal dialogue or conflict within the mind of Shlomo HaMelech, debating with himself various views, almost like a comparative religion course, various views of philosophical worldviews, only one of which we will identify as the Yirei Elokim, the one who fears God. The other three are not. So it tells us already that we should not be afraid of the verses and perspectives that may not convey a holistic Torah ideology, and should not worry us, because they are voices within the internal dynamic of the Sefer. At the end of the day, Kohelet has a conclusion, and it's the conclusion that will carry the debate. It's the conclusion that is the voice of the winner, so to speak, in this internal dialogue, and we will explore in more detail what that dialogue is. But that essentially was in a nutshell, the vort that we suggested last week, and based on that, we're going to develop the Sefer, the voices, who's speaking to whom, who are they addressing, what's going on, and that is our exercise for us. One more little piece of introduction and from a methodology point of view, or pedagogical point of view, and that is that one of the misleading pieces of Kohelet that is most problematic is its chapter division. Chapters in Kohelet are very misleading. They probably have done more to confuse the meaning of the Sefer than anything else. They are haphazard. Yes? You certainly can. That'll be finished in a few minutes, but you're certainly welcome to move up. You're welcome to move up at any time. Doesn't have to. All right. The Prakim division in Kohelet is misleading. It's also illogical. There are places in Kohelet where the chapter divides literally in the middle of a dialogue, in the middle of a sentence. Chapters that begin with Vav. My English teachers always said, never start a sentence with the word and. Never start a paragraph with the word and. Certainly never start a chapter with the word and. But there are sentences, there are mid-sentence, psukim that are literally, you can see that the chapter divides one phrase in the middle. Why? I have no idea. What I do know is that the chapter division is not of Jewish origin. We know that the chapters were introduced by the early Christian printers. And I'm not beholden to the chapters in any way, shape, or form. The only thing I'm beholden to is the masoret of the parshiot division, and that we will address, how many paragraphs there are in Kohelet. The chapter divisions we will have to drop. Most of us are familiar with Kohelet because we read it every year in shul. I have this issue. Every time we read Kohelet, we always stop at the end of the chapters. stop. We raise the trump. We change the trump at the end of a perek. Sometimes in many shuls they change balei kriya in the middle of from perek to perek. We mark the end of prakim when we read the sefer. I'm not sure why we pay so much tribute and give so much honor to the Christian printers who divided Tanakh into chapters and did us such a disservice. That's a separate issue. But we have to be careful when we study the Sefer that we are not beholden to a division that is not of our own. So from the outset, we're going to look at Kohelet as a text. We are going to reference chapter and verse for the benefit of all being on the same page at the same time. But practically, interpretively, the prakim mean nothing to us for now.
Are there openings and closings?
Yes, but you won't find them in an art school Tanakh, Chumash. You won't find them except unless you look at a Tanakh. There are a few Tanakhs over there. If you want, you're welcome to grab one. It's one of the reasons I like to teach out of a Tanakh. There are, in fact, two. One at the end of, middle of Perek Aleph, the end of Perek middle of Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud Aleph, and the other is at the end of Perek Vav, beginning of Perek Zayin.
They have it?
They have it?
It's hard to see it. But
it's hard to see it.
The space there.
Yeah, there are two. There are two parshiot essentially, one Petucha and one Stuma, one open paragraph, one closed paragraph, which we'll talk about a little bit later, and then there is one Shira in the middle. There's a few different places. Structurally, we'll come to the structure of Kohelet as well. Let's start from the beginning. We read this last week. We're going to read it again. This is our focus for today. Divrei Kohelet ben David Melech b'Yerushalayim. The words of Kohelet, son of David, king in Yerushalayim. I told you last week various interpretations of the word Kohelet. The classic is that he gathered, the Kahet lehakil, gathered much wisdom. The twist is in Rav Meidan's article on Kohelet is that it may also come from the word makhela, which is a choir, or a multiple of voices singing or dialoguing together. So that Kohelet could actually be a Kohelet of voices in this context. Kohelet ben David melech b'Yerushalayim, son of David, king in Yerushalayim. There's only one king of Israel that fits that description, and his name is Shlomo. Havel havalim amar Kohelet, havel havalim hakol havel. Everything is hevel, hevel of hevels, says Kohelet. Everything is hevel, hevel of hevel. What is hevel? Futile, vanity, mist. Mist is probably the most literal translation of the word. Hevel picha means the warm air that comes out of your mouth when you speak. It is void of substance, no meaning, it has no value, it's just there. And probably in that context refers to Kohelet's frustration, something which is of lacking meaning. To call something hevel in modern Hebrew means it is of no value. It comes from that notion of this warmth that comes out of the air that comes out of your mouth, which is of no value. To use the English idiomatic expression, you can talk about somebody who is blowing off steam or talking hot air coming out of his mouth. Idiomatic expressions in English that essentially say the same thing. Ma yitron la'adam b'chol amalo she'amol tachat ha'shamash? What benefit is there to man in all of his toil that he should toil under the sun? Dor alech v'dor ba. Generation comes, generation goes, and the land or the earth continues. Le'olam omadet. Continues for eternity. Vizarach ha-shemesh, uva ha-shemesh. The sun, zarach, zricha, the sun shines, uva ha-shemesh, and the sun sets. Ve'el mekomo shoef zoreach husham, and to its place it strives, it yearns, it shines forth there. Meaning, what is it referring to? What does it mean? Zorach Hashem, Meshuvah Hashem, Ve'el Mekomo Sho'et Zoreach Husham. You look like you're about to say something.
At the earth is round, so it's going to its place in a different part of the world. But you might fight.
Leave out the connection between these two psukim for a moment. Look at pasuk hey by itself, without address to pasuk dalet. Right? Or were you not referring to pasuk dalet?
If you don't know physics, you might think that the zareach is actually some substance, the ray of light. And Shoefet could be, it's sucking it back. It's taking it back in, as if it has some physical nature to it.
To put it in a simple terms, what essentially is he describing?
The sun rising and the sun setting.
The sun rises, sun sets, and then it rises again. Thank you. Simple terms, that's what Kohel is describing. Before we get into physics, before we get into whether the earth is round or whether the earth was flat, and did they know that the earth was round, Machloket Rishonim, whether or not the Gemara thought that the earth was round or whether the earth was flat. Before we get into all of that, those broad philosophical and physical issues, simply put, sun rises, sun sets, and then it strives to rise and shine forth again.
If you look at the words, it almost implies that when it sets, it's going someplace, that's Makomo, and while it's in that place, it's still shining. It doesn't say it's coming up again.
I don't see that. I see it comes back to its original place, El Mokomo, place where it started, and then it shines forth again. Halechel, you'll see the next three psukim and you'll tell me if you think you go, and then you'll go back to Pasuk Hei. Halech el Darom v'sovev el Tzafon. Halech el Darom, it goes to the south and comes back in a circular motion to the north. Sovev, sovev, holech haduach. The wind goes round and round. Ve'al sevivotav shavaruach. And around this circuit, the wind returns to where it started. Kol hanichalim holchim alayam. V'hayam enenu male. All of the rivers feed into the ocean. And the ocean never
fills.
El makom shehanichalim holchim sham hem shavim lalachet. To that place where the rivers go, guess what? What happens to the rivers when they feed into the ocean? Somehow, they end back at the rivers. Do you understand why the word makom throughout this Perek refers to the starting point of whatever cycle he is describing. Kol hadvarim yigayim. All of these words are weary. They tire you out. Kol yuchal ish ledaber. You cannot speak them. Lo tizba'ayin lirot. You cannot see them. Lo timale ozem mishmoa. The ear cannot be filled of hearing them. Hamash shehaya hu sheyeh. Hamash shenasa hu sheyaseh. What was will be. What was done will be again. Ve'ein kol chadash tachat hashamash. And there is nothing new under the sun.
In Pasuk Vav, is he talking about the sun going north and south?
No, the wind. He's talking about the wind. He shifts the pronoun is first, the subject is in the second half of the phrase. A little bit of a grammatical, poetic license. Correct. He shifts subjects. He shifts subjects. The sun is going east and west. The wind is going north and south. Yesh davar shi'amar eze chadash. Somebody will say, oh, there's something new. Kva haya lo olamim asher hayu melefaneinu. It was for eternity. And the years gone by. Ein zichron l'rishonim. We don't remember what was in the early days. And that which will be in the future will be forgotten and won't be remembered by those who come after it. Things constantly get forgotten. That's why we think there's something new. But in the end, we realize there's nothing new. And kol chadash tachat hashamash. Ani kohelet hayiti melech al Yisrael b'Yerushalayim. I, Kohelet, was king over Israel in Yerushalayim. Another reference to Shlomo HaMelech, for a number of reasons, but one of them being there's only one king who could ever claim that he was king over Israel in Yerushalayim. And that was Shlomo. Because for David, there wasn't yet a split between Israel and Judah. There was one Malchus. The end of Shlomo's life, you already have the beginnings of that split. And by the time you come to his successor, you have two kingdoms, Yehudah and Yisrael. The statement that I was king over Israel in Yerushalayim, if you understand it in its political context, has a unique status and application to Shlomo. I was king. Why it's in the past tense is an interesting question. And I made it my business to seek, to understand, to explore the wisdom of everything done under the heavens, and evil matter that God has given man to afflict him with or to challenge him. I'm going to stop here for a moment because we are going to focus on the first part of this parak, Psukim Aleph through Yud Aleph. But if you look at the text carefully, you'll see very clearly that Pasuk Yud Bet is a new introduction. And if we were to look at the Sefer structurally, Psukim Aleph through Yud Aleph serve as an introduction to the Sefer. From Pasuk Yud Bet and forward, we're into part two. Why do I say that? Two reasons. Why do I say that?
First person.
Changes person, although that will become much harder to identify, but I'll accept that as a transition between third person in the introduction and first person in Pasuk Yud Bet. Ani Kohelet? I? There's certainly a change of voice. That will be one indicator we will be using throughout the text, although it will become less clear as time progresses. And so now there are three reasons, because that wasn't one I was anticipating. Another two reasons why I say that Pasuk Yud Bet is a new transition, new beginning, new introduction.
Paragraph break,
that's our first Parshiyah Ptucha. Right? The first Psukim Aleph Yud Aleph is one paragraph, Pasuk Yud Bet is a new paragraph. And thirdly?
Just descriptively, the first part is declarative statements about the way the world is, and the second begins with his attempts to seek and discover.
Okay, we actually haven't read what the second part is. It's going to be five chapters long, but I only read one pasuk for the sake of stopping. But I think you're on to something, or closer to something. Take a look at pasuk Aleph and compare it to pasuk Yud Bet. What is Pasuk Aleph? Divrei Kohelet ben David melech b'Yerushalayim. These are the words of Kohelet. Pasuk Yud Bet? Ani Kohelet ayiti melech ha'Yisrael b'Yerushalayim. Right? The past tense isn't so much the issue as much as the introduction says, this is the book of Kohelet, king of Israel. Now, Pasuk Yud Bet starts, I, Kohelet, king of Israel, what do you have? King over Ben David, Melech B'Yishalayim. Yeah, but that's not the issue. It
sounds like a new beginning.
It sounds like an introduction, prologue, and book, and text. If I were writing a book, and I say, and I was writing the dust cover, what do they call it? The dust flap? The dust jacket? And I was writing who the author is. I would say, this is the book written by Kohelet, son of David, king in Yerushalayim, who wrote the following summation of his work. Okay, that's your introduction. Open up the chapter. First sentence of the first chapter is, I, Kohelet, king of Israel, and I made it my business to explore, etc. It's clearly written as an introduction, and then the book itself. And then the text. So Psukim Aleph to Yud Aleph serve as a mavoa, serves as an introduction to the whole Sefer. They are the critical Psukim because, although dust jacket is usually not written by the author, in this case it is, but it's an it's a statement that essentially tells us what we are going to find in the Sefer. And it tells us the whole structure of Kohelet in one nutshell. 11 psukim, understand these 11 psukim, you'll understand Kohelet. Not quite. Not quite. We will get to what he says in a moment. But I first wanted to see the structure. Okay. Clearly, there's an introduction. These 11 psukim will serve in that capacity. We will now begin to try to analyze what these psukim are saying. But they tell us, they give us the structure of the book. Essentially, they come to a conclusion. Right? The conclusion of, as you said, what is the conclusion? There's nothing new, there's no value, en kol chadash, havel havalim, everything is futile, what was will be, the exercise has already been done, everything's been said, as it says at the end of Kohelet, sof davar kon nishma, all the arguments have been made, and his introduction comes to the conclusion, havel havalim, everything is futile. And then, in his opening sentence, his opening volley, if you will, is Ani Kohelet ben David. Ani Kohelet hayiti melech ha'isor b'Yisholayim v'natati et libi lidrosh v'latur b'chochma. And I made it my business to explore, to seek wisdom. Now, if he starts with the perspective that everything is futile and everything is useless and everything was will be and there's no point to the exercise, then why does he say, that I made up my business to seek and to understand? What's the transition here between this declaration of futility and then he starts this quest? A quest to understand.
Does he want to show how he came to this?
One possibility is to assume how he came to this conclusion, which would assume that the conclusion of the book is in line with this opening chapter. I would say that is a possibility if I didn't know where the book ends. But since we know how the book ends, that can't be the correct interpretation, because this introduction is just that. It's his starting point. Kohelet begins with this futility of Havel Havalim. That's not where Kohelet ends. He ends with a declaration of emunah, with a declaration of faith. He ends with a profound loyalty to God. He ends with sof davar kol nishmat elokim yira u'mitzvotav shmor. That's not the voice of Hevel Havalim. So, whereas normally an introduction tells you this is the conclusion of the book, in this case it's not. In this case, the introduction is not telling you what his conclusion is. It's telling you what his starting point is. His starting point is this frustration with the world. And we will define that frustration. His starting point is a frustration of the world. He looks out of the world at a superficial glance, and what he sees is what was will be. En kol chadash, hevel havalim. Once he's put that on the table, now his quest begins. His quest it's not the conclusion of his quest. It's the challenge that motivates his quest. He is challenged by this phenomenon he sees in the world. He sees Hevel Havalim. He sees this useless, purposeless cycle that ends, everything ends where it begins. And it bothers him. So he puts it on the table. And then, now that that's on the table, Ani Kohelet ben David Melech b'Yerushalayim. I now start the following search. Natati et libi lavur b'chochma kol asher nasa tachat hashamayim. I have made it my quest to seek, to yearn, to understand, to try to explore all that has been done under the heavens. So this is an introduction. But it's not an introduction because that's his conclusion. It's an introduction because that tells us what motivates the quest, what motivates the challenge. And what does he say in this introduction? What's his basic principle or premise? What's his basic premise?
Nothing changes.
Ein kol chadash. That's his premise.
Now, you have to strain your eyes a little bit. We're getting a bigger one, but for now, we're going to do it this way. Ein kol chadash. There is nothing new.
Nothing new.
The only problem with that is with regard to knowledge, and that isn't true.
Well,
because we know things now that they didn't know 2,000 years ago. And you can make the argument there was some other group of people who did know, but
so that's a fair question.
Science and, things that can be discovered.
That's a fair question. When he begins to explore knowledge, we'll come back to that question and ask it again. For now, we're going to take it as an assumption that he's frustrated in some level. But your point is well taken. When he's going to address various components of his life and why he perceives this futility of purpose. And we'll ask the question, is he correct in his assumptions, or is he challenge it? Can we challenge the assumptions? We'll go there. But I'm going to hold it for now. He gives a number of examples to the fact that Ein Kol Chadash. What are they?
Sun.
Okay.
Start with the second. Shemesh. Zerach. Bat. And then returns to Mekomo. The sun rises,
sun sets, and then returns to its place, which means it starts the process all over again. So here's an example of why he says, Ein kol chadash tachat ha-shemesh, there's nothing new. If I look at the cycle of the sun, what do I see? The sun rose tomorrow, and it rose this morning, and it set this evening. And guess what's going to happen tomorrow morning? It's going to rise again. So what's the purpose? It's like a roller coaster ride. You start and you end in the same place. What did you get for the journey? You have to pay for the pleasure. That's the first point. Another example.
Number one is with the generations.
Oh.
Number one is Dor Holech, Dor Ba. Generation comes,
a generation
goes.
Ve'ha'aretz li'olam amadet. And the land continues, endures. Essentially, people come and go. Generation comes, generation goes. But at the end of the day, the earth continues its existence, so it had a few more people on the world. And after 120, those people are where?
In
the earth. And a new generation is born, and after 120, those people are in the earth. V'yashov ha'afar el ha'aretz kishehaya v'aruach chazor v'yashov ha'afar el ha'aretz kishehaya v'aruach. That happens when you read Sukkim by heart that you... Yeshov afar al aretz kishaya baruach tashuv el elokim asher netana. The dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. That's how Kohelet ends. That's how Kohelet ends. Or one of the final psukim of Kohelet. Haaretz, the land, the afar, the dust of the earth, out of which people are made, continues from generation to generation. So there's a few more people, a few less people in the world. But at the end of but after the cycle is over, what do I have? From dust we come, from dust do we return. And what do I get for the process? Second example. Third example.
el darom, sovev el tzafon, the wind starts in the north, goes to the south, comes back to the north. Wind goes around the world. It's interesting that the sun rises, the sun goes around the world in one direction, the wind goes around the world supposedly in another direction. Don't ask the meteorologists how accurate this is physically. That's not really my interest right now. Shlomo Melech was not a physicist, but he was a philosopher. And in the world of philosophy, what do I have? Another cycle. A cycle of wind. I have the cycle of the wind that goes around the world, north, south, again and again and again. And what does it obtain? What does it achieve in the cycle? What happens to the wind in this process? Does it change at all?
No.
It ends up exactly where it started. It's an amazing phenomenon. We start in the fall, we end up in winter, we go to spring, then we hit summer. And one thing you know for sure during the heat of the summer, that fall is coming. When you get to fall, you get the winter to look forward to again. When you get to the winter, you get the spring to look forward to again. And then you hit the summer again. And it goes, it's an amazing thing. It goes again and again and again. Sovev, sovev, alech, havuach. Last example. Kol hanichalim holchim elayam. Ve'ayam enenu male. All of the rivers end up in the sea. And the sea never gets filled. And what happens is, el makom mishanachalim holchim sham him shavim lalachet. So I have the nachal, or the water, going into the yam, returning to its place.
All of the things that he says are futile are things he has no control over.
That is correct. That is correct. We're not finished yet. That's correct. At this point, they are all phenomenon of nature, and he has no control over the phenomenon of nature. That is absolutely correct. Not only are they phenomenon of nature, if we look at them from a certain perspective, afar, shemesh, ruach, and mayim, and we break it down into earth, fire, wind, and water, not only are they elements of nature, they are, right, they are the four states of nature, which we can go back to the history of science and the history of physics and when they thought that these were the four basic elements of nature, but that's less the issue, as much as he's looking at the world that is defined by nature. In all of its facets, these four elements make up the totality of the world of nature. I break nature down to its constituent elements, and what do I find? That each element reflects a certain cyclical nature that always brings me back to my starting point. Now, the physicists have also discovered this point. They call it the law of conservation of matter and energy. But it has a different connotation in that context. But the message here is that I look at the totality of nature and I draw a conclusion. And the conclusion is that nature is an endless, purposeless, useless, cyclical process. And its futility is precisely because I always end up where I start. It's one big cycle or circle. And therefore, havel havalim. When he says, Ein kol chadash tachat hashamesh, there's nothing new under the sun. There's nothing new because I keep ending up where I start. So I never get anywhere.
Also, there's nothing new because everything was created in the first 7 days of creation.
He hasn't addressed creation here. There's not a word of creation in this parak. He will get to creation. Without question, but not here.
Here he's addressing, he's looking at nature. He's looking at what is, not where it came from, but what is. Looking at what he sees. He's a philosopher. In a certain sense, he's a scientist. He looks at what he sees in the laboratory. What he can't see, what he can't measure, is irrelevant to him. He looks at what the world that he sees in the laboratory of philosophy, and he comes to the conclusion that everything is futile. Yeah?
Pretend that it's science, and it really comes up with a hypothesis. And the hypothesis is, instead of looking at these things in nature, here's what you see. Cyclical, useless, et cetera, et cetera. And the next stage, you would always...
challenges the hypothesis.
How does that apply to human beings?
Oh! Whoa, now, wait. Now you've hit the nail on the head. There's a piece missing here. There's a piece missing here. There are a few pieces, but there's one piece, significant piece, missing, which even from the perspective of Shlomo HaMelech, even from the perspective of the Kohelet philosophy, I can't leave this introduction without addressing this piece that's missing. What's missing? Man.
I think evolution's missing. Because man is just one component. If you believe in evolution.
I don't think the evolution is an issue. First of all, Shlomo HaMelech wouldn't have known the vocabulary of evolution.
No, I agree.
Okay? So I'm trying to understand the world, the Sefer, from the perspective of Shlomo HaMelech. Okay. Evolution is not an issue that's of any relevance to Shlomo HaMelech. It will be relevant to the end of the Sefer in a certain component when we get to the conclusion of the Sefer and the principle of Emunah, we can talk about it. But from the point of view of what you see in the world, if you want, I can break down each one of these cycles and try to identify from a scientific point of view of what value that cycle has. But that's not where he's going at this point in the session. But to look at the four components of nature and to look at them as cyclical and to draw a conclusion from that cycle of nature, to draw the conclusion that the world of the human being, that the world of man is futile, that's an unfair philosophical jump. Get to the question of whether or not the cycles are legitimate. But from a philosophical, logical point of view, how do you look at the cycle of the water or the cycle of the wind and conclude, therefore, that the world of man, of the human being, the world of desire and feelings and creativity and energy and mind and soul, and that world is now futile because the water goes back to where it starts? Where's the logic there? And that's exactly what he does. He takes this cycle, defines it as the representation of nature, and says, therefore, the world of the human being, hevel havelim. But there's a logical jump, a logical inconsistency there. We're looking at this from a point of view of a work of philosophy. It's a book of philosophy. So it has to be logical. Where's the logic?
It doesn't necessarily have to be logical. If, ontologically, you're suggesting that, possibly that he's at the end of his days, and he said, I spent my whole life seeking wisdom, and you're saying that this is his beginning point, his starting point. So it's obviously when he's a young man before he's done this whole process, and that's his.
Even as a young man,
what?
Even as a young man, it would be completely absurd to look at the cycle of the sun rising and setting and saying, therefore, there's no purpose to the human being. Sun has no desire. It has no creativity, it has no will, it has no benefit, it doesn't enjoy. We are human beings of creative energy. We enjoy things, we benefit from things, we can contribute, we can build, we can create, we can... Where's the world of man in all of this?
Do you mind if I challenge you again? I used the word evolution before, but I want to expand on it because you obviously didn't catch it. Evolution is referring to all of life and its changing of life. So in this case, not you were talking about man, but what about an animal? What about a dog can enjoy himself? Give him a nice bone. You've limited it to just he's missed man, but I'm saying he really missed all of living organisms that reproduce and
I'm not sure I would agree with that, only because I mean we could argue the question of free will and the soul and the difference between the human being and the animal kingdom. But it's not going to change where I'm going to go with this. So I'll accept that for now, and we'll move on. Yes.
It seems to not have noticed that even though the sun goes on its cycle and the river doesn't fill up and the wind goes round and round, but they're always changing. He didn't notice that even then, even though the cycles are the same, there's some change in everything.
Yes,
you
know? But the changes may be so insignificant that they are meaningless. At the end of the day, the cycles that he's identified are pretty solid, stable cycles.
Today, it would be a different story.
If I observe some phenomenon which is repeating, and I don't see idea behind this phenomenon, am I to assume that there is no idea?
For now, I will take it as a given that Shlomo Melech will conclude whatever he wants based on the information that he has before him, and that is a legitimate exercise of philosophy. The truth is that is the methodology of philosophy. Philosophy, from its very inception until modern times, is the process of intellectual analysis based on the materials and the information that I have before me. That's what philosophy does. It looks at the world, the facts on the ground, and it draws the conclusions based on the information that I have, not information that I don't have. So it's a legitimate exercise. May draw different conclusions, but that's also legitimate.
But if you jump to the...
Just 1 second, yes.
I can't fully address why cyclical things might not necessarily have meaning. I think philosophers would talk about something with a purpose or a distance, but just staying close to the psukim, if you look, as you said, at the beginning of psukim having to do with nature, he does mention man, but he might be saying if you look at man just as an animal, one of nature, he's finite and he lives and dies. It's only the last psukim where then he adds the notion of man. Somebody uses words, so then he moves to the next level, away from nature, and now beginning to introduce the idea that we think and try to make order.
He does mention, and that's very interesting. Pasuk Chet, he dives directly into the world of man. Lo yuchal ish ledaber, lo tizba'ayin lirot, lo timale ozen mishmoa. Man cannot speak, nor see, nor hear, because there's nothing to hear, see, or speak that hasn't already been heard, seen, or spoken. Mashaya hu sheyase. So he comes to the conclusion, and that's the fascinating part of it. He does come to the conclusion that the world of man is futile, and he derives it from the cyclical worlds of nature. That's the inconsistency here. That's the jump. He absolutely delves into the futility of the world of man, and he gets it from the world of nature, and that's the problem. So let me suggest to you a possible solution to this problem, because it's really, this is where we are going to find our thrust into the Sefer of Kohelet. Amongst the many literary methodologies open to Shlomo HaMelech and Tanakh is the use of allegory or parable. And it is entirely possible that the elements that are being described here and the cyclical nature and the cycles of nature that he is addressing are not in fact cycles of nature at all, but that he is addressing the world of man couched in the allegory and metaphor of nature. Now I say that for a reason. There are many mishalim, there are many places in Tanakh where the Navi employs the use of allegory or mashal, or chida, riddle, as it's often called. Shlomo Melech, Shimshon, most famous riddle in Tanakh, probably. Shimshon's famous riddle to the Plishtim, where he says, where he comes to the Philistines and he challenges them with a riddle, and he says, if you can solve this riddle in 7 days, what's the riddle? Az yetzam matok, from the strength, from that which is strong, will come that which is sweet. Me'achel yitza ma'achal. From that which consumes emerges that which is consumed. Now, the simple resolution of that riddle is, you know the story in Sefer Shoftim, what is the solution of that riddle? From the strong comes the sweet, and from that which eats emerges that which is eaten. What is the solution to that riddle?
Wasn't it that lion?
Right. He saw something. He saw a lion, carcass of a lion, in which bees had nested and created a hive, and emerged, and out came from that carcass came honey. So the honey is the sweet that came out of the strong, and that which consumes, which is the lion, which normally consumes others, is now consumed himself. Of course, you understand that that's not what Shimshon meant. Shimshon was not taunting the Philistines with a little riddle about lions and bees. In the worldview of Shimshon, what was he talking about? He was talking about the state of the Jewish people and him as a response to the Plishtim. Who is the strong? The Plishtim. And who will be transformed into the honey that will be consumed by that which is not now weak? The Plishtim. Who is going to transform them? Shimshon. And Shimshon is going to turn the Plishtim from the Ochel into the Ma'achal. Shimshon's riddle is a threat to the Plishtim. Doesn't think that they'll get it in a million years until they finally figure it out. So there's three levels to the Mashal. There's the riddle. There's the solution of the riddle, which is to understand the symbolism of the riddle. And then there is the resolution of the riddle, which is to solve the challenge that the riddle creates. In Shimshon's case, the riddle was the lion and the honey. The riddle was the strong and the sweet, the eater and the food. The solution of the riddle was the lion and the honey. Or actually, the solution of the riddle was Shimshon. And the resolution, or the ability to resolve the riddle in the challenge that the riddle created, was the Philistines' challenge to Shimshon, or their ability to get to Shimshon and to conquer Shimshon at his own game. What we have in Qohelet is a similar level of Mashal. Why do I say that? If you take a look at the end of the Sefer, take a look at Perek Yud Bet. One of those examples that I mentioned earlier of a perek that starts in the middle of a sentence. It's a very strange thing. Perek Yud Bet starts Uzuchor, and remember, middle of a sentence. But for now, we'll start there. Uzuchor et bo'echa b'yimei b'chuvatecha ad asher lo yavo yimei hara'ah. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before those days of evil come upon you. And you reach those years which you say, I have no desire. Ad asher lo techshach ha-shemesh v'ha'or v'hayareach v'ha-kochavim. Until those days when the sun and the light and the moon and the stars will become dark. V'shavu he'avim achar ha-gashem, and the clouds will cover over the rain. Bayom shiazu shomrei habayit, the day in which the guardians of the house begin to falter. Vehit avtu anshei hachayil, and the soldiers begin to become crooked. Uvatlu atochanot ki me'etu, and the grinders cease, for they are few. V'chashchu haro'ot ba'arubot, and the seers in their cavities begin to become dark. V'sagrud latayim bashuk, and the doors in the marketplace shut. Bishval kol tachana, because the grinder, sound of the grinder, has ceased. What are we talking about? Somebody please tell me what we're talking about. We are talking about a very profound, very poetic description of the process of old age. Of the body breaking down, step by step. I'll read the psukim again. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before those days of evil come upon you, years which you say, I have in them no desire. Until the time when the sun and the stars begin to close on you, begin to darken. Meaning? The eyes are failing. Bayom Shiazu Shomrei HaBayit, the guardians of the house begin to shake. Rashi says there's also reference to the eyes. Hitavtu Anshei HaChayil, the soldiers begin to be crooked. What are the soldiers?
Legs.
The legs. Ubatlu Tochanot Kimeitu, and the grinders cease, for they are few. Loss of teeth. And that which sees out of the chimneys are darkened. Blindness. Sagrut l'tayim bashuk, the doors of the marketplace shut. Reference to? Right, the lips. We can consume the food. Because shvolt kol tachana, because the grinding has ceased, so the lips close. Then he describes the process of psychological breakdown, of fear that grips the person. Pasuk vav, v'savavu, or the end of pasuk hey. Ki olech ha'adam el beit olamo, v'savavu bashuk hasofti. For a person is headed to the world, to the, what is Beit Olamo? Right, to his eternal home. Remember, Olam always means, right? Tanakh, Olam always means always. Right, the word Olam is a reference to the world, is a rabbinic use of the language. Tanakh, Olam always means always. Beit Olamo is a cemetery. Right, Beit Almin is a cemetery. And the Savavu has Sofdim Bashuk, and the professional eulogizers are already walking in the marketplace. Where? Because the right, person is dying. Or has already died. Ad asher yunatek or yiratek chevel hakesef v'tarutz gulat hazahav, until the gold, the silver cord is broken, and the golden Lata Zahav, the golden crown, bowl, is smashed. V'tishaver kad al amabua, v'narot ha-galgal al abor, to the pitcher is broken, and the wheel returns to the pit. Which is a very graphic description of not death. Death we have. The person's already buried. And the decay of the body in the grave, the decomposition of the body, and finally, conclusion of the metaphor: dust returns to the earth, and the spirit returns to God. Most powerful, poetic, frightening description of the process of death, of old age leading to death and burial, in all of Tanakh. And all couched in metaphor. All couched in riddle of mashal. If Kohelet ends with the mashal of the human being in terms of the references of nature, it stands to reason and logical that Kohelet begins with just such a mashal. Not only that, if we take a look at each one of these phrases and identify them in the Sefer, we will find what they represent in the Sefer. They're not arbitrary phrases. They represent something in the context or an arbitrary aspects of nature. It's not just of the cycles of nature that he's identifying. He's identified cycles of nature and used them metaphorically to describe the very issues of the human being and the human condition that Qohelet is challenged by. And let's do them one at a time. Let's start with, I'm going to do them out of sequence though, so you'll bear with me. Why? Because that's how I have it in my notes. That's why. If I go out of sequence of my notes, I'll be in trouble. So let's start with water.
What's the key phrase in the cycle of water? Kol hanechalim holchim el hayam v'hayam enenu malay. All of the rivers, all of the oceans head into the river, and the river is never filled. I can pour into the river, into the ocean, as many rivers as I want. And the more rivers that pour into the ocean, seemingly, the more room the ocean has for more rivers to flow. The water goes back, and we start all over again. And it seems that all the rivers flow into the same place. And it just has an endless, unsatiable appetite for water. Take a look at the end of Perek Vav. Perek Vav, Pasuk Zayin. Kol amal adam lefiu. Kol amal adam lefiu. Vegam hanefesh lo timale. Interesting phrase?
Yeah.
It's structurally identical to this phrase at the beginning of the Sefer. Kol anachalim olchim alayam bayam enenu male. All of the rivers flowing to the ocean is never filled. All of one's toil of the human being, what happens to it? Lefihu. What does it mean, lefihu? What do I do with all my toil? What do I do with all the possessions and the worldly efforts that I have created in this world? I eat them. At the end of the day, the most basic representation of all of my achievements is food. I can build and create and amass wealth so I have more money to feed my bellies than I can possibly imagine. And you know what happens with the more food I eat? The hungrier I get. V'anefesh lo timale. The soul is never satiated. The amazing thing about material possessions and materialism is that the more I have, the more I want. It's frightening. But it's true. Never satiating. It's an endless thirst. It's an endless hunger. And the more I feed it, the hungrier I get. So suddenly my very simple metaphor about the cycle of water and the oceans and the seas, the rivers flowing into the ocean, becomes a profound metaphor for a fundamental component of the human condition, namely insatiable desire to consume.
In Pirkei Avos it says, happy is a man who is satisfied with his life.
That is true. And if Shlomo HaMelech would have read Pirkei Avos, maybe he wouldn't have written Qohelet. That is true. Shlomo HaMelech is at this point very far from that mission in Pirkei Avos.
Well, he knows that from his own life.
And you only have to look at Shlomo HaMelech's life himself to realize how much of this is a reflection, this we'll do next week, how much of this is a reflection of Shlomo's personality. Let's take a look at the second one. Another cycle that he talks about. V'zarach ha-shemesh uva ha-shemesh, ve'el mekomo sho'ef zareach hu sham. The cycle of
the sun.
The cycle of the sun. So what is the cycle of the sun? What does the sun represent in Kohelet? If the Mayim, so far, has represented the soul, the unsatiable soul, the desire for physical pleasure, what is the representation of the Shemesh, of the sun? So let me show you a couple of psukim. Take a look at Perek Bet, Pasuk Yud Gimel. V'ra'iti ani shiyesh yitron lachochma min ha'sichlut ki yitron ha'or min ha'choshech. There is advantage to wisdom over folly as the advantage of light over darkness. Hechacham einav b'rosho v'aksil b'choshech holech. The wise has eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. I'll give you another example. Perek Zayin, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Tova chokhma im nachala, v'yoter l'ro'ei ha'shemesh. Wisdom is good when it's accompanied with inheritance. Meaning, it's very nice to be very wise and philosophical. It's even better if you can be wise and philosophical and make a living. Tovat chokhma im nachala. It's good to have wisdom. It's better to have wisdom and parnasa. Right? But if I can only have one or the other, listen carefully. If I can only have one or the other, the yoter, the yitron, the advantage, goes to ro'ei ha'shemesh, those who see the sun. Meaning, back to my metaphor, those who have wisdom. Wisdom is always a metaphor for, the shemesh. Or the sun, or light, is always a metaphor for chokhmah, wisdom. So I have the nefesh hamit she'enenu malei, I have the unsatiable soul of physical pleasure in the water. And I have the intellectual depth of philosophical thought of the human being in the sun. What are my last two cycles? Wind and earth. So let's do the afar first, because that's the easiest. What is the symbol of v'dor alech v'dor ba v'yaretz lamamadet? What's the metaphor? This one's easy. V'yashov ha'afar al ha'aretz kishayar baruach tashuv al alokim ha'shir netana. This one he tells me. This one he gives me the solution right at the end of the sefer. Right, the physical achievements of man, the physical body, the guf, and sovev sovev holech ha'ruach ve'al sevivotav shafer ruach, and the ruach. V'yashov ha'afar al ha'aretz kishayar. The solution of the last two, Afar and Ruach, I have in the Sefer itself. The physical body versus the soul, the spirit of the human being. So at this point in Kohelet, what I have essentially are four different metaphors. In these four states of nature, I have four different components of the human being. So when I ask the question, where was man? And if I look at it just on the level of the world of nature, I'm missing man, and then he jumps to the conclusion about the experiences of the human condition, which is an illogical jump. But if I start with the premise that each of these symbols of nature are really a representation to the human condition, what's challenging him is something about the human condition that is rendering each of these elements futile. The water that is insatiable, because the human desire for physical pleasures is insatiable. The more I eat, the more I want. So where does it get me? All of the wisdom and intellectual capacity of an individual who is described as the smartest man alive, correct? And who will declare in Perek Bet, Ki mikre haksil gamani yikreini, velama chachamti ani az yoter. What is the end of Shlomo HaMelech? Where is Shlomo HaMelech going to end up? In the grave. And where is the fool going to end up? In the same place. And the brain of the fool and the brain of Shlomo HaMelech are going to decay and decompose exactly the same way. And Shlomo didn't have the option of leaving his brain to science. So what did I go through the process for? Futile exercise to become wise? I amassed enormous knowledge. What happens to it? What happens to me? And then, the body, the physical achievements of the human being, the afar, the building, the physical structure, what can I build? I can build enormous structures. Remember what Shlomo HaMelech built? He built a Beit HaMikdash. He built cities. He built towers. He built fortresses. He built everything. And where did it get him? What do I do with everything that I build? And Shlomo HaMelech will say, "Sha'anichenu la'adam shi'ya acharai." I should leave it to the one who comes after me. Shlomo HaMelech is plagued by an issue, by a challenge. And all of Kohelet is designed to conquer that challenge. And one of those challenges is death. Because it destroys all the achievements of every one of these great pillars of his existence. Wisdom and physical pleasures and achievements of buildings. And then, into all of this, we're going to throw our fourth component, namely the spirit. The one unpredictable variable in the story. So Shlomo starts with the mashal. With each one of these metaphors of nature represents a different component of the human body, the physical body, the intellect, the desire, and the spirit. And they become translated into the four key personalities of our sefer, namely the amal. And he talks about amal as a word for toil and building, which is essentially the man of afar, physical man, the man of body, the nehene, what in Greek philosophy we would call the hedonist, the man of pleasure. In the context of our metaphor, the mayim. The chacham, the philosopher, intellectual man, which is the shemesh. And for reasons more of what's left than anything else, I have the Ruach. And the Ruach will represent our fourth personality, which we have yet to introduce in depth, but we will in Perek Hei, namely, the Yirei Elokim. Those are essentially the four voices in Kohelet. And they are introduced to us in metaphorical terms from the very opening verses. Let me just go one step further, and let's look at that pasuk in which he jumps into the world of man, his conclusion, pasuk chet. Kol hadvarim yegeim. All of these matters are weary. Lo yuchal ish lidaber, v'lo tizba ayin lirot, v'lo timale ozen mishmoa. Nor can the man cannot speak. The eye will never be able to see, and the ear will never be filled enough to hear. V'lo timale ozen mishmoa. What's he saying? Go back to this for a moment. Remember that my ruach is going to stand alone. Because of my voices in Kohelet, the ruach is the only one that A, remains undefeated, and B, carries the debate. So we will see that the ruach essentially is the antagonist to the other three. It's the only one that survives the process of death. The only one to survive the process of death is the Ruach. So we'll come back to the Ruach separately. But if I look at the world of the Amal, the world of the doer, the builder, the creator, the world of the Nehneh is a world of receiving, of accepting, of benefiting. And the world of the Chacham, which is the world of understanding, of seeing the sun and the light of wisdom. Now put this verse of Pasuk Chet, to the world of man, into this context. What do I have? Lo yichal ish ledaber. Man cannot speak enough to achieve his goals. Which man? The Amal. Who is trying to do, trying to give, trying to create. Ledaber, to speak. To contribute. And no matter what he does, his exercise is going. The exercise is futile. There's nothing he can say enough or build enough to make the exercise worthwhile. Lo tisba ayin lirot. The eye cannot see enough. Right? Ayin, the seeing, is the world of the Chacham. Velo, and here it's interesting phraseology. Velo timale ozen mishmoa. The ne'eneh is the mayim. Or the nefesh that is never filled. Hayam enenu male, v'nefesh lo timale. The ozen, the ear, can never hear enough, can never receive enough to satiate itself. And all of the exercises end up futile. That's the world of man. And that essentially is the introduction to the personalities of Kohelet or the voices of Kohelet. Now, I have 3 minutes left, and in those 3 minutes, I will tell you the following. If Kohelet begins with a challenge of this endless, futile cycle of the human condition, my assumption must be that where does Kohelet end up? Kohelet is a book. It has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an end. If my I have to assume that he's going to end up with a resolution of the futile cycle of the human condition. I have to assume that that is going to be the conclusion of the book. And when he reaches that conclusion, I also have to assume that his solution or resolution is going to include a reference back to the four states of nature, at least the metaphor with which the Sefer began. Fair assumption?
Yeah.
Fair assumption. So let me give you a hint as to where we will find that. We will do it in depth when we get to chapter 11, but let me give you a hint as to where that is going to go. Open up for a moment to Perek Yud Aleph. Perek Yud Aleph is the final, we're going to call them speeches for a lack of a better term, the final speech of the Yirei Elokim. It's the speech that carries the day. That the victory speech in the debate, appropriate time of talk about debates. Right? This is a debate, and in this case, there's a clear winner in this debate. Perek Yud Aleph begins, "Shlach lach mocha pnei amayim, ki berov hayamim timtzaenu." Cast your bread upon the waters. Eventually, you might find it. What does that mean? What does that mean? What does the sentence mean? Possibly. When we use the expression shlach lachmacho, what do we mean?
Have patience.
It means we don't know if the effort's worth it.
But try
anyway.
Take a chance.
But try anyway. Take a chance. You never know. Try anyway. You'll never know. And he says, Ten chelik l'shiva v'gam l'shima, ki lo teida ma yiyeh ra'ah la'aretz. Put a portion away for the future, because you don't know what calamity is coming. Invest for a future time. I Kohelet said there's no point because it's all going to get destroyed. You never know. You so sure that it's endless? So sure that it's worthless? Shlach lachmacha. Do you guarantee that the water, that bread is going to come back to you? No. But the alternative is worse. Not everything do we know. Ki lo teida. If the clouds fill with water, they will empty that water upon the earth. What is he referring to? Rain. It's interesting. You know, the cycle of water that he spoke about at the beginning, which takes the rivers and brings them into the ocean. And so the end of the water ends back in the rivers. And you say, okay, so what's the purpose? Well, we don't see the purpose right away. But you know what? Along the way, you get rain. And rain has a way of giving life and blessing. Vim yipol etz b'darom vim b'tzafon makom sheyipol ha'etz sham yehu, which is an exact paraphrase and structure to the sentence about the wind. But you know what the wind does when it goes from the north to the south and back to the north again? In this endless futile cycle? You know what it does? It carries with it something. What does it carry with it? Seed. Seed. And when it carries the seed, it plants the seed. And suddenly you get new trees and new life.
Well, when you cast your bread in the water, maybe somewhere down the stream, a hungry man will find it.
That's right. Shomer ruach lo yizra, a person who looks for the wind and who says, okay, I will plant only when I know what the weather is going to be for the next 3 months. Shomer ruach. What will happen? Lo yizra. He'll never plant. Because v'ro'eb avim lo yiktzor, the person who's waiting to see what the clouds look like, will never harvest his fields. Because we are the best meteorologists in the world, never go beyond 4 days. Because it's unpredictable. Kasha encha yodea madera charuach. You don't know the way of the wind. You don't know God's deeds. Lo tedat masei Elokim. Babok ezra adzarecha v'le'erev al tenachet yadecha. In the morning, plant your seed. In the evening, don't hold back from planting your seed. Seed in the ground, seed of man. You don't know which will be more successful. Your economic success or your success with your family. But do both. Matok ha'or, the light of wisdom, is sweet. It's good to see the sun and to have wisdom. And at the same time, we use korot yamei ha'choshech to remember that there are days of darkness coming. Because, Pasuk Tet, Veda. This entire perek is based upon one phrase. The phrase is, Lo Teda, what we don't know. There's a lot we don't know. Perek Aleph starts with the ultimate presumption. I know everything. Because the only thing that there is to know is that which I can see and analyze. The world of the Amal, the world of the Chacham, the world of the Nehaneh, is a world of in which I judge what I see and feel and can measure in a laboratory. The world of the Yirei Elokim is that there's much more that we don't know than that which we do. But there's one thing we know for sure. V'da, ki ha'kol elev yecha ha'elokim b'mishpat. Because for everything we do, there is judgment and there is accountability. And what he does in this last parak is he weaves together all the metaphors of the whole sefer, the wind and the fire and the earth, and he draws back to the conclusion and he says, Kohelet, you fool! So you based everything on what you know nothing! You're driving up a mountain, and at the top of the mountain there's this road that goes up to the top of a hill. Now, when you're driving up the hill, can you see the road at the other side of that hill? No. So if you draw your conclusion based upon what you see, then you better stop now. Don't even bother driving up the top of the hill. But the only reason you drive up is because you have faith. And on the other side of that hill, there's a road that opens up into a beautiful valley. We live based on what we know and what we live based on the faith in that which we don't know. Because we live by faith. We have that emunah. We have that yirat elokim. That's the conclusion of the sefer. So I've told you where Kohelet starts, and I've told you where Kohelet ends. Between Perek Aleph and Perek Yud Bet, we have our work cut out for us. Mm-hmm.